This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. A genetically modified variety of corn is causing tremendous headaches for the grain industry. Farmers and every major food and agriculture company are scrambling, affected by BTCRY9C, also known as BT corn, or by the trademark name Starlink. The corn has been approved for use as animal feed, but approval for human consumption is still pending. Why hasn't this corn been approved for human consumption? What are the benefits of genetically modified crops? Those are just two of the questions we'll tackle this afternoon as we look into the potential of genetically modified foods, the potential for good and the potential for harm. Our guest this afternoon is Alan McEwen. Alan McEwen is a senior research scientist at the University of Saskatchewan. He also chairs the International Biosafety Advisory Committee of the Genetics Society of Canada. And he is the author of Pandora's Picnic Basket, The Potential and Hazards of Genetically Modified Foods. McEwen himself has developed genetically modified plants. And early in his book, Pandora's Picnic Basket, he writes, quote, "I am in favor of an orderly and appropriately regulated introduction of some genetically modified organisms into the environment and marketplace, and I adamantly oppose others." Listeners, I encourage your questions this afternoon for our guest, Alan McEwen. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Alan McEwen, good afternoon. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Celeste. Nice to be with you.
Nice to talk with you as well. I thought we would begin with some very, very basic questions. For example, what is genetic modification?
That's a perfect question to start with, because that's really at the root of the lot of the confusion and misinformation in the current state of the debate. Typically, governments and scientists refer to genetically modified plants and organisms as those that had undergone some recombinant DNA or genetic engineering technologies. But most people seem to think that it implies a number of other things. You know, there was a survey conducted just late last year, and even I was surprised at this. But you know, one of the lead questions was, "Are you concerned about genetically modified foods?" And of course, most people said yes. We have some concerns about that. The follow-up question was, "Well, just what is a genetically modified food, in your opinion?" And a surprising, the majority of respondents said, among other things, that a genetically modified crop was any one to which a chemical had been applied while it was growing. And if we apply that particular definition to genetic modification, then pretty well everything we eat is genetically modified. So we have to make sure we know what we're talking about when we're discussing the pros and cons of this. But certainly almost all of our crops have at least one chemical applied to them during the growing season.
Yeah. Now, people have been breeding plants for many, many years, thousands of years. Is genetic modification different from traditional plant breeding techniques?
Well, it's similar in that in both situations you're changing the DNA. You're creating a new plant or an improved animal breed by changing the DNA inside each and every cell. The difference with genetic modification using recombinant DNA technology is that the only DNA we're changing are the portions of the DNA that relate to the particular gene of interest or the attribute of interest. So with traditional plant breeding or animal breeding, we combine thousands of genes from two selected parents. And in genetic modification, we add just one or two genes.
Mm.
So it's much more precise in that respect. On the other hand, it is a newer technology. We've only been able to do this for less than 30 years.
Yeah. Thinking about this and reading through your book, you know, I found myself wondering, should we be concerned about crop production methods other than genetic modification? I was surprised, for example, to read about mutation breeding. Maybe you would take a moment and describe that technique for us and answer this question. Are there risks associated with these other more accepted older forms of plant breeding?
Well, there's no question of that. I mean, there are risks associated with every technology, whether it's genetic modification or traditional plant breeding or mutation breeding, whatever. And what we as a society have to do is ensure that our regulatory system is aware of the real risks and takes the appropriate steps to keep those potentially hazardous products off the market. Radiation breeding has been with us for about 50 years. It's produced something like 1,700 different crop varieties around the world. And it's considered a conventional technology in that the products are not regulated to the same degree that genetically modified new varieties are. But we have a pretty good idea. We as plant breeders have a pretty good idea what the types of risks are, and we watch out for those in new varieties that are coming under review for eventual commercial release. And so far, there's been very little difficulty with new varieties getting onto the market that have caused harm. We tend to identify them before they get to the marketplace, but they certainly do pop up from time to time, again, whether we're using traditional plant breeding methods or genetic modification methods.
Hmm. Something else that I think I kind of knew from hearing reports of Starlink and the problems with marketing this crop overseas and that kind of thing, that there are different regulations and rules country to country, and even the definition for genetically modified organism differs country to country. Have there been efforts to come to a common definition of GMOs on which to use as a foundation for regulatory policy?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question of that. I mean, the countries are in international negotiations constantly. There's a meeting of the OECD next week that I'm going to that has as one of its primary goals to try to harmonize regulations concerning these things. The World Trade Organization is another one that's in constant negotiation to try to get some commonality. And like most new products, it's going to take some time before people in different countries see the common ground and work towards facilitating international trade.
Yeah. The issue of safety is at the top of concerns about GMOs. Are GMOs safe for consumption by humans and or animals, and are they safe for the environment? How does science go about answering these questions? And after science has a hand, how do the regulators go about answering those questions?
Good question, and there's no question that the number one priority that everyone has and the number one question is, are these things safe? Scientists look at safety issues, and they cannot provide a guarantee that anything is absolutely safe. Scientists identify safety really by the absence of hazard. So when we look at a product, when we scientists look at a product, we try to say, okay, what are the hazards associated with this product? Is it toxic? Does it have toxic qualities? Does it have allergenic qualities? Does it have a feature that will make it of greater fitness in the environment so that it might disrupt the local ecology? These are the types of questions that we ask and conduct experiments to try to get answers to. And at the end of the day, we say something is safe if we can't find anything wrong with it. Now, that is not good enough for some people who want an absolute guarantee of safety, but science just cannot provide that. Regulators, of course, take a slightly different approach. They have to address both the scientific aspects of whether this product is hazardous in some respect, but they also have to incorporate the political realities and provide assurance to consumers and the public in general that we've looked at these products, we've determined that as far as we can tell, they are at least as safe as other equivalent products that are in the marketplace, and therefore we don't anticipate a problem. So a little bit different attitude, but at the end of the day, I think they come to the same conclusion.
Yeah. Do you think there could be improvements made with our regulatory approval process?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that all of our bureaucracies can stand improvement, and we like to complain about the wastage of our tax money and so on, and how inefficient they are. I think to their credit, though, our regulators, both in the U.S. and Canada, can point to their track record and say, look, we've been dealing with genetically modified organisms since the 70s. We've been regulating them. We've kept products off the market that we thought were unsafe. And so far, we have not had any documented cases of harm coming to consumers or the environment from them. So you might not like exactly everything we're doing, but you can't say that we're doing a bad job. So, there's a fair amount of credibility in that. On the other hand, they themselves are continually looking at ways to improve the regulatory system, and both in the U.S. and Canada, they're constantly under review, asking outside experts to say, are there ways that we can improve this? Can we be more efficient?
Mm-hmm. I'd like for you to tell us the story of the proposal to take a gene from the Brazil nut and place it in beans. A couple of questions. Why put a nut gene in a soybean, and how and why was that idea ultimately abandoned?
Well, it actually started quite a few years ago. Grain legumes, including soybeans and peas and beans and lentils and so on, they're pretty nutritious in general, but they're missing a couple of, or they're poor in a couple of essential amino acids, methionine and cysteine. These are sulfur-containing amino acids. And a number of people around the world, not necessarily in North America, but they have a diet that's very rich in grain legumes and very little else. And as a result, they can suffer the consequences of deficiencies of these particular amino acids. So the original idea was to take a gene, and a gene is simply a recipe. It tells the organism how to make a particular protein. They were going to take a gene that was rich for these particular amino acids and put it into grain legumes, not necessarily soybean for feed consumption in North America, but some of the other grain legumes that people use for food, particularly in parts of Africa. And the idea, of course, a very noble objective, was to try to give a better nutritional balance to these grain legumes. So when the scientists first started looking around to see where they could find a source of a gene that would provide a protein rich in these amino acids, they found that the most rich source was actually in Brazil nut. The Brazil nut itself produces, there's about 10,000 proteins in the Brazil nut, and one of them is responsible for being very rich in these two particular amino acids. So the idea was to take the gene from the Brazil nut, put it into grain legumes, and that way they would provide these essential amino acids to the grain legumes. Now, this was later picked up. The first company that started working on this kind of failed on it. They didn't get very far, but it was picked up by Pioneer, and they thought, well, gee, maybe we could revive this project. And instead of putting it into food grain legumes, we could put it into feed grain legumes that we feed to our animals, because the animals, of course, suffer the same deficiencies if their diet is high in grain legumes that lack these amino acids. So they went back to the Brazil nut, managed to isolate the gene, put it into the soybean, and lo and behold, in their first set of analyses, realized that, yes, the gene worked fine, the Brazil nut gene did provide the recipe to the soybean. The soybean happily produced this protein that was rich in the cysteine and methionine. But at the same time, it also carried over the allergenicity of Brazil nut. Now, as many of us know, a number of people are allergic, severely allergic, mm-hmm. to Brazil nuts, and they may not necessarily be allergic to soybeans. So they would be, I think, quite tragically affected if they ate these particular GM soybeans with the Brazil nut in them, little realizing that they, had this Brazil nut allergenic gene in it. So the project was shelved. The whole program to nutritionally enhance soybeans was shelved as soon as the company realized that, their chances were like 1 out of 10,000 that they picked the same gene out of the Brazil nut that was responsible for allergenicity in the Brazil nut and transferred it across to soybean.
So essentially it never got out of the laboratory.
No, it never got out of the lab, but the testing and the regulatory system, I think, shows a couple of things. First of all, that the regulatory system works in that it identified this potentially hazardous product before it got out onto the market. And the other thing it showed is that the fundamental nature of the gene remained the same. Even though it was transferred from one species, the Brazil nut, into soybean, the gene remained the same in that it produced a protein that was enriched for these amino acids, and it even maintained its allergenic properties. So it was it did not substantially change its character, even mm-hmm. though it was transferred into a completely different species.
Have there been other potentially hazardous cultivars developed then abandoned?
I think that happens pretty well every day. I mean, every plant breeder investigates thousands of different lines. Some are rejected for various reasons. I mean, either they don't perform very well in the field under agronomic conditions, and sometimes for nutritional reasons. You know, they're poor in some essential nutrients, or they have an enhanced level of anti-nutritional chemicals naturally occurring, and I think all of our foods contain these. But You know, most of our consumers were blind to this fact. They don't realize that soybeans actually have a whole range of these chemicals that we would prefer not to be in there. But we monitor the amounts of them. Breeders monitor the amounts, and if they come across a line that, even though it may perform very well on the farm, if it has elevated levels of some of these chemicals, it gets tossed. It doesn't get developed for the market.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Our guest this afternoon, Alan McEwen, he's a senior research scientist at the University of Saskatchewan. He is also the author of Pandora's Picnic Basket, The Potential and Hazards of Genetically Modified Foods. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I encourage your questions this afternoon on GMOs. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We have some callers waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Our first listener that we're going to hear from this afternoon is on line 4 in Terre Haute. Hi.
Good afternoon. I'm interested in understanding the mechanics of how in the laboratory you take a gene off of a chromosome of one plant and transfer it onto the chromosome of another plant. I can't understand that at all.
That's a good question. It goes right back to basics. Really, the one-word answer, enzymes. Scientists have a series of different enzymes that attack DNA. They chop it into pieces, and they're smart enzymes. I mean, they actually recognize the particular base sequence of the DNA that they're supposed to snip into pieces. And over a period of years, starting in the 60s, really, scientists have identified about 300 different enzymes that will cut DNA at different particular base sequences. As you know, DNA is made up of the chemical bases A, T, C, and G, and it's that the order of those particular A, T, C, and G fragments that make up the long molecule of DNA. And these enzymes can actually read those particular chemicals, C, C, A, G, T, and make a cut between, for example, the A and the T. Now, when we apply these enzymes to the DNA, of course, it cuts the chromosome into many different fragments, and then through painstaking work, we can separate all those fragments according to their sizes and then transfer them into usually bacteria and see what actually happens. I mean, what do those fragments do? And eventually, after a number of years and a lot of experiments, many of which don't work, we can track down and say, okay, well, this fragment of DNA, you know, when we use this particular enzyme on this particular DNA from this particular organism, it results in a protein that we identify, and then we know what that particular gene does. And from there, you know, we have the gene isolated. There's several different methods, actually, of introducing that gene then into the recipient cell. Sometimes we start out with bacteria because they're most easily genetically engineered. In fact, all we have to do with bacteria is grow bacteria in a culture and add the DNA to the culture medium. And some of the bacteria will actually take the DNA from the culture medium and incorporate it into their own genomes. When it comes to plants and animals, it's a bit more tricky, but there are several different methods. One of them, the most commonly used one for plants, is actually a natural method because there's a naturally occurring bacteria called agrobacteria that, as part of its nature, takes a piece of DNA from inside the bacterial cell and inserts it into the plant cell. Right? In the wild, these agrobacteria attach to plants that are growing nearby, and pieces of DNA are actually inserted into the plant cell. So what scientists have done, and this was back in the early 80s, have identified certain strains of these agrobacteria and provided the agrobacteria with the genes that the humans want in the plants. And the agrobacteria quite happily delivered that DNA that the humans wanted into plant cells and culture. So that's the easiest way.
So does this usually take place during the reproductive cycle or...
Genetic engineering occurs at a cell level. I mean, every organism is made up of cells,
right.
And every single cell, every living cell, contains the DNA required to reconstruct the entire organism. And so what happens in the laboratory, at least, is that we take certain of these agrobacteria containing the genes of interest that we have introduced into the agrobacteria, and then we apply the agrobacteria to usually some cell cultures growing in a test tube or a petri dish. And the agrobacteria does what comes naturally to it, and then we just grow out the cells of the plant. We stimulate it with hormones and nutrients and so on, and that stimulates the cells to grow back into a whole plant. And from that point on, I mean, it flowers, it's that seed, and it continues on as an ordinary plant, except it has this added gene from the agrobacterium.
Can you identify the location on the chromosome using the electron microscope, or what kind of technology do you use?
Well, if you use an electron microscope, all you see is DNA, and one piece of DNA visually looks pretty much the same as another piece of DNA.
Uh-huh.
However, we can use chemicals to separate the DNA and fragment it and look at particular fragments of the DNA to see where the DNA was inserted by the agrobacterium. Now, it's said that when you use agrobacterium or one of the other methods of introducing DNA, it's inserted more or less randomly into the DNA of the host. And to some extent, this is true. And this is why we usually use, or at least in my lab, I like to get about 100 different plants that has the same gene inserted in it, because each of those 100 will have the DNA inserted at a different location. And then we just go through and we decide, you know, which of those 100 different now transformed plants contains the gene of interest in a reasonable location that doesn't seem to interfere with any of the other functions of the plant.
So, okay, very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks for the call this afternoon. Next we go to a listener on line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. Great program, though. What is an appropriate time scale to determine the hazards or the safety risks associated with GMOs? And the second part of the question is there an analog to the prions that we're hearing about so much in BSE in the plant area? And could the guest comment on those two questions, please?
Yeah, good point. The time scale for determining a hazard, well, that varies. You know, some people will say forever, basically. As a scientist, I would say it could be very short. And certainly, you know, the example of the Brazil nut and the soybean, that only existed for maybe a few weeks or months before, you know, the dramatic hazard was identified, and then that project was stopped altogether. So you investigate something until you find a hazard, and particularly if it's a dramatic one like this Brazil nut one, you know, it can be a very short period of time before it's killed entirely. Otherwise, you continue on looking, trying to identify or waiting to hear about particular hazards with particular products. But if you don't find any, you know, at what point you say, okay, well, I guess it's reasonably safe. Most of the products, most of the genetically modified food products that are on the market now were developed and tested for about 10 years. So, you know, that gives us a pretty good idea. If a problem does not arise within 10 years, then it's unlikely. Not impossible, but unlikely. And that's, I think, a pretty reasonable standard time frame. The second part of your question, the prions, yeah, it was really interesting, actually. Back in the 70s, there was a disease in potatoes that was identified as being, well, of course, we didn't know about prions in those days, but they, I think it was called a viroid, and it was just a very, very tiny fragment, and people had been wondering for years just how these potato diseases work, because ordinarily, you know, when we have diseases in plants, much the same as in humans, I mean, they're either bacterial or viral or fungal, but in this case, nobody could really find what was the cause of these diseases. So, yes, indeed, and it's likely that prions and other similar pathogenic agents exist in all organisms. It's only now that we've come to be able to identify what's actually causing these diseases.
I want to thank the listener for his questions this afternoon, and we're going to talk with another listener now on line 1 in Champaign County. Hi.
Hi. The concern about Starlink was also a allergy problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, the
one of the suspicions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the suspicion was that the Cry9C protein was slower to digest in the gut, and because of this slower digestion, it shared an attribute with which is common to a number of allergens. So, I think the prudent question was, well, how do we know this CRY9C protein isn't going to cause allergic reactions? And the regulator said, okay, well, let's hold off on this and investigate this more closely to see whether it shares other attributes that are common to allergens and so on. And that's what actually happened.
Is someone studying the route that the Starlink gene took? Are these naturally occurring organisms you refer to that are used in the lab? Are they snipping? And I understand that this snip point is a weak point. We've had a fellow from Food First, which has a website, foodfirst.org, and he is a chemist, talking about this issue. And he pointed out that, among other things, having BT everywhere is going to ruin it for the people that are using it in a more discriminate way, like organic farmers, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's going to be so ubiquitous is going to mean that it's likely that insects will develop resistances, and then it'll ruin it for everyone. But that's outside of the economic analysis of an individual corporation, I suppose.
Well, there's a lot of different corporations developing BT, but you're right, and I think the scientific and regulatory community is aware that the overuse of BT is going to lead sooner to insect populations that have resistance, and then, as you say, that's going to ruin it for other people who are using it, whether they're organic farmers or conventional farmers, or even home gardeners who still use BT. And this is part of the reason that the regulatory system involves management strategies to delay that onset of populations with resistance as long as possible.
What about the ideas? Who's studying the route that this thing actually disseminated? One of the points that this fellow made was that most of the research money from the federal government, in this country at least, is going towards, you know, finding uses for this as opposed to studying possible unintended consequences. Now, I think you'll probably say that that's built into the methodologies, but I think there's a lot of people that are suspicious of that.
Oh, I'm sure there are, and I think it's good to be suspicious, and I think it's great to raise these questions, and let's get particularly our public scientists working on these questions. Now, I know a fair number of university scientists, of other government scientists in the U.S., particularly in the U.S. USDA, who have very similar concerns and are scrutinizing a lot of these questions. They're spending a fair amount of money. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the figures, so I don't know what proportion goes to the development of the uses as opposed to questioning what are the real hazards both to human and animal health and to the environment. But certainly it's not being overlooked. I know there are some excellent scientists in the U.S. and around the world who are very concerned about these things and are conducting experiments just to get a handle on exactly, how much should we be concerned about them.
Well, how did Starlink get everywhere and ruin the prices for all these farmers out here that are absolutely irate and are suing the manufacturer? I have to listen to your spiel here and hang up on listening on the air.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. Aventis put the CRY9C gene into corn. They went out and they sold it as a feed type corn. But as you know, and I'm sure most listeners realize, that somehow this feed style corn ended up in the food chain and it was identified. And then, of course, all of these problems arose with the marketing. Now, this clearly is a regulatory problem. It was not supposed to have occurred. It did occur. And I think the lesson for us is that it's almost impossible to keep segregated a feed-type gross commodity like corn or soybean from the food types. It will cost a lot more money for our food if we're going to have that level of segregation. It should not have happened, clearly. I'm not supporting Aventis and the sloppiness of the system. But on the other hand, if we look at conventional products, conventional varieties, occasionally we do see feed-type barleys and corns and soybeans ending up in the human food chain. It's just some of the slop that happens. This caused such a fuss because the slop, the contaminant, happened to be genetically modified, but it happens virtually every day.
So BT corn is in the food chain. I think we can say that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There are a number of varieties of genetically modified crops containing the BT gene that have been approved for human food use.
Okay, so what is it?
It's just this particular one variety.
Huh. Why has this one particular variety been held up for approval?
This one particular variety contains a modified gene. I think this was one of the points that our last caller was alluding to. Aventis made a couple of changes to the gene. It is not exactly the same gene as is found in nature or is found in these other approved genetically modified crops. But they made some modifications to the molecular structure of the DNA to make the Cry9C gene. And it's still basically fundamentally the same, but it may have some different attributes. And one of the different attributes certainly is the longer digestibility.
Mm. Any reports of allergic reactions? As this was a concern that it was an allergen.
Well, that's right. Now, this happened back in November, I think, when this first blew up. And as far as I know, there have not been any reports of allergenicity. And, of course, the scientific community has been debating, how real is the allergenicity threat. Some scientists say, well, it's a real enough issue that it is the prudent thing to do to take this off the market and investigate further and so on. And other scientists say, the likelihood of this being allergenic is really minuscule. I guess after, two or three months now, with no reports of allergenicity occurring, the likelihood is that it's probably not allergenic.
Let's talk with another listener. On line three, a caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. I know that the U.S. General Accounting Office, in their FDA drug review about post-approval risks in 1990, said, quote, more than half of all drugs approved by the FDA are withdrawn or relabeled due to unforeseen side effects in humans, which do not appear in animal tests, unquote. My point is that when people talk about all the testing that goes on, it is a very flawed process, probably most basically because there are just too many ways or too much unknown about what's toxic and what isn't, and every time someone comes on and tries to minimize that huge problem, I think it just shows a kind of biased starting point. Number two, you talked about how a gene was placed into a early on, you talked about how a gene was placed into, now I forget what the organism was, but anyway, you said that, and it expressed exactly the way it did in the original organism. Well, the latest news that is perhaps more relevant is that we now have a genetically engineered primate for the first time. They called him Andy, and they put in a marker gene, and it is not expressing, and they don't know why. It was supposed to fluoresce, and they think possibly it might express, when he's older, but they don't know. So that's an example where a gene is placed into an organism much closer to us than the one you were citing, and it did not express correctly. And third, the thing about the and final thing here, and then I guess I'll hang up and listen to your response, is that the thing about the prions, where you just have a different physical shape to a molecule, say, which therefore causes all these problems. And then you add to that the point where you said that one of the problems that you were citing earlier, where they just modified a gene. Well, I mean, that's the way most of these pharmaceuticals make their money, I believe, is they just modify things so that they can get patents for them. So, I would guess the major activity is going to be in making these small modifications to natural genes or, genes as they found them, in order to get a patent for them. Would you respond to any of this? Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm happy to respond to all of them. I certainly, you know, your first point about we don't know everything there is to know about the risks, and you said the testing procedure is flawed. Well, I certainly agree that we don't know everything there is to know, and I certainly agree that there's no absolute certainty of non-risk in these products. But on the other hand, I would disagree. I think that we do adequate testing of things because, I mean, look at the track record. The regulators can quite rightly point that we've had very few problems with foods, particularly put on the market, regardless of the technology used to develop those foods. Now, you know, when you say we should increase the regulations or you or other people suggest we should increase the testing and so on, my question is, well, what tests would you like to see done that are not currently done? And secondly, are consumers willing to pay the additional cost of these tests when, in most cases at least, they don't seem to be warranted by the hazards of the products when they finally get on the market? I mean, if people buy, gooseberries or kiwi fruit or something that's not particularly common in North American diet, some people are allergic to them perhaps, some people don't like the taste, but for the most part, they're generally safe foods in that, you know, most of us can eat those things without undue harm. But very little real testing has been done on those things. So, you know, where do you draw the line? On your second point about the expression problems in our genetically modified primate, Andy, that was also the case with the Brazil nut and soybean. And it's kind of curious that genes are ubiquitous. I mean, every organism, from bacteria to plants to animals to humans, we all share the same genetic code, so that when you transfer a gene from one organism to another, the recipient organism can read that recipe and make exactly the same protein as in the originating organism that provided the gene in the first place. But what is very often different is the switch, because every gene, and if you consider a human with, you know, 100,000 genes, every cell contains every gene, but every cell does not actually operate or express every gene. So there's a switch that turns the genes on in the right tissues, and at the same token, in a different species, a different switch will turn the gene on in different tissues or different circumstances. And what happened with our Brazil nut gene going into soybean is that the Brazil nut switch, the promoter, had to be changed so that it would be a switch that would be recognized by the soybean. I suspect the same situation is occurring with our primates. I think it was a jellyfish gene that was put into the primate, and you're saying that the expression was poor or non-existent. The likelihood is that the gene promoter has to be altered to make it something that the host primate will recognize and then operate that particular gene. Your third point, you were talking about prions and drugs testing. I forget exactly what point you were making there.
Yeah, but one of the important things I think he made the point at the end is, this is a way for large companies, to pull down patents and pull down billions of dollars. And,
yep.
You know, often we have been told as consumers this is completely safe, only to come back and say, well, we got to rethink that. And I think this is a really important issue.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. And certainly, you know, I don't trust anybody who tells me something is completely safe, right? I say, okay, what have you done? And what are you trying to get across here? I don't know any scientist or any regulator who would actually say that about any product. The best I would hope to hear is that, you know, we've done the same amount or more testing on this product, and it is at least as safe as the product it will compete with or will replace. And that has a lot more credibility as far as I'm concerned. Now, the patenting situation, sure, I mean, this is, you know, these companies are in business. They want to take products, improve them if they can, and then acquire a patent on them. That's part of doing business. And if the product is truly an improvement, then, according to the U.S. system, they deserve to have that patent, and consumers are more willing to pay a little bit more for that improved product. And, of course, the point here is it truly improved? And, of course, is it safe?
Should GM foods be labeled?
As what?
as containing genetically modified organisms?
You know, this this is a major issue because most people say yes. Most people say they want to have the choice. They want to see the food product labeled if it's produced from genetic modification technology. And I'm certainly supportive of consumers who want to know what's in their food. I think people do have a right to know how their food was made. But when I start thinking of the mechanics of how you actually apply this labeling scheme to genetically modified foods, I'm not sure how it would work, just in a practical sense. And the reason for that is our current labeling scheme, both in the U.S. and Canada, is objective. It's based on the chemical composition of the food. For example, when the manufacturer says low in sodium, well, it's easy enough to verify that. I mean, you can take a sample of the food, take it to any university lab, and do a test to see whether it truly is low in sodium. But when the product says made from a genetically modified product, then there's no way to verify that. You know, the system, the regulatory system, goes from being objective to being subjective. If you take a bottle of corn oil, and whether it has a label on it or not, there's virtually no way of knowing because the chemical composition of that oil is identical, whether it came from a genetically modified corn variety or a conventional corn variety. And in most cases, they're blends anyway. The varieties, particularly of corn in the U.S., genetically modified versions make up such a large proportion that the likelihood is when you buy a bottle of corn oil, it's probably blended from varieties of different types. So, you know, that's just one of the problems. There are a number of other issues with the labeling as well.
Yeah.
But certainly the labeling regulations as they exist at the moment require a label, and we're going to see more and more of this. They require a label if the chemical composition is changed substantially or if it contains an allergenic compound or a toxic compound. So as long as that corn oil is identical to what corn oil was in the past, then no label is required.
Last question, because we're here at the end of the time that we can spend together today. Could a GM food lead to the creation of new allergens?
Conceivably. Now, I mentioned earlier in the show that I think allergens are a real issue, right? I mean, there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of misconceptions about hazards with these things. But allergens and toxins are things that I am concerned about with genetically modified foods. You know, we have the example of the Brazil nut and the soybean being a real live example of something. And conceivably, there could be novel proteins created and put into foods that do have allergenic properties. Now, most of the genetically modified foods are composed of genes and proteins that are already in the food chain. We know that they're not allergenic. When they're introduced into the different food type, they remain non-allergenic. The Starlink gives an example of a situation where a modification was made that gave the protein one attribute that gave the impression that perhaps this is allergenic. Allergens do share a lot of common characteristics, and the Starlink situation, the Cry9C protein, had one of those attributes. So we do have an idea, long before we actually get down to feeding trials, whether a new food product or a new protein has allergenic properties or not.
Hmm.
So it gives us a starting point.
I'm going to squeeze in one more question. Mm-hmm. Given Starlink and the concern over the allergen issue, in the future, should approval or disapproval for animal and human consumption be issued simultaneously by regulatory bodies?
Yes, and I think that's going to occur. I think that's one of the fallouts from this whole Starlink fiasco is that the regulators have decided they are no longer going to split a feed approval from a food approval, and hopefully that will help satisfy some of the concern.
Alan McEwen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Alan McEwen has been our guest this afternoon. He's a senior research scientist at the University of Saskatchewan. He also chairs the International Biosafety Advisory Committee of the Genetics Society of Canada, and he's the author of Pandora's Picnic Basket, The Potential and Hazards of Genetically Modified Foods.